So I think fiscal dominance is probably the best way to describe it. And so fiscal dominance is when fiscal policy, like specifically large sovereign deficits and debts, constrains the effectiveness or the options for central bankers for monetary policy. So for a common thing, for example, if a government is running a very large deficit and the central bank is basically forced to monetize it because they can't let the sovereign bond market go illiquid or otherwise dysfunctional, then they're basically unable to fight inflation the way that they would prefer to. And so we've seen kind of signs of that.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. In order to succeed, it's critical to understand the rules you're playing by, and the rules for investing may have recently changed. There's a good argument to be made that we're now in an era of fiscal dominance, and today's guest, one of the smarter you'll get a chance to hear from, is certainly making that case. So, what exactly is fiscal dominance? Why is it important for investors to understand, and which assets will do well and which will do poorly in such an era? To find out, we've got the good fortune of speaking today with Lynn Alden, investment strategist and author of the recent book, Broken Money: Why Our Financial System is Failing Us and How We Can Make It Better. And if time allows, I'll also ask her for her outlook on the dollar, gold, and Bitcoin. Lynn, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here as always.
Hey, it's always a pleasure. And Lynn, this is the first time I'm interviewing you, actually after having met you in person, and I just want to tell the audience, the only thing better than watching a video interview of Lynn Alden is actually getting a chance to meet her live. She's a wonderful person. So anyways, Lynn, that was really enjoyable.
I appreciate that. It's great to meet you as well.
Well, thanks. Hope we get to do it again soon. Okay, lots of questions for you. Obviously, I really want to dig into the topic of fiscal dominance with you. Before we do, if we can just kick this off with the general intro question I always like to ask you when you come on, what's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
So I think fiscal dominance is probably the best way to describe it. And so fiscal dominance is when fiscal policy, like specifically large sovereign deficits and debts, constrains the effectiveness or the options for central bankers for monetary policy. So for a common thing, for example, if a government is running a very large deficit and the central bank is basically forced to monetize it because they can't let the sovereign bond market go illiquid or otherwise dysfunctional, then they're basically unable to fight inflation the way that they would prefer to. And so we've seen kind of signs of that. And like fiscal dominance is not one of those things you're either in or out. There are shades of gray in the middle where you can kind of start getting into it. And, you know, the central bank hasn't lost all of their options, but their opportunity set, their option set is diminished compared to what it would otherwise be. And so when people think of fighting inflation, they often think of Volcker, right, in the 1970s and early 80s. But people have to keep in mind that the federal government back then had only 30% debt to GDP.
Right.
And most of the money creation that time was, even though deficits were an issue, most of the money creation was not from deficits. It was from bank lending. There was a very high rate of bank lending happening in addition to real constraints on things like oil, for example. So you had a real world geopolitical issue, and then you had rapid bank lending money creation. And so his policy there was raise rates and slow down the rate of bank lending. And that had the effect of it did increase the fiscal deficit, but not very much because it's only 30% debt to GDP. The interest expense on the deficit was bigger, but the downward pressure he put on the private sector was larger than that. In addition, it hardened the dollar. And and this is kind of the brutal part of it. It would squeeze out, for example, Latin American countries. They had all this dollar-denominated debt. It would put them into a depression. They would consume less oil. They had like a lost decade in oil consumption. And therefore, it alleviates the price and the supply constraints of those limiting factors. So that's basically the strategy that was employed back then. And he had a lot of flexibility because, one, the presidents, you know, both Carter and Reagan were on board with that strategy. And two, he wasn't constrained by the fact that, you know, because public debt was pretty low. The problem is that, and Powell faces a much harder challenge because, although at the moment he has less geopolitical issues, right? So oil is still in a pretty comfortable range for the most part. The challenge he faces is that federal debt is 120% debt to GDP. And so When and more and the fiscal deficit, unlike the Volcker era, the fiscal deficit is larger than the sum of annual new bank loans and annual corporate bond issuance in the country. And so the majority of money creation, the majority of kind of how money's circulating, the fiscal side is like equal or bigger than the private side. And so when he raises interest rates, it does put downward pressure on the private sector. So bank loans slow down, corporate bond issuances slow down, companies and real estate operators run into some frictions, and it kind of puts that downward pressure. But then it also blows out the fiscal deficit at a 4 times bigger rate than it would do under Volcker, because that entire 120% debt to GDP debt load starts refinancing over time at those higher rates. And so that interest expense blows out by like $1 trillion if those rates are kept high and for long enough. And that starts offsetting some of the downward force because for all that government deficit, including the interest expense, is someone else's income. And they, it doesn't have as high a velocity to spend it as, say, a stimulus check does. But that spending velocity is not zero. And so the overall kind of tools become less effective. And I think that we've kind of gone through this phase where in 2022, the downward force they were putting was pretty effective. So it started to squeeze the private sector. We saw most signs of economic deceleration, if not outright recession. So purchasing managers' indices rolling over, kind of manufacturing activity rolling over, GDP growth rolling over, two negative quarters in a row, even of real GDP growth. All these kind of things were rolling over. But what we started to see by around either late 2022 or early 2023, depending on what metric you're looking at, we started to see that the interest expense was growing to such an extent and actually starting to stimulate certain things. And so some of those things started bottoming, even though the monetary side was still tight, because the tight monetary policy was contributing to even looser fiscal policy. And so the deficit started to blow out, various economic indicators started to bottom. And then when they damaged the banking system, instead of just kind of following through with it. If they wanted to fight inflation, they could have said, well, look, I mean, if banks blow up and if uninsured depositors lose money, well, then that destroys some of the money supply, right? They could have done that, but that would have contributed to instability. It would have been unpopular. And so instead, they blinked and they provided liquidity and solvency to the banking system. So they kind of prevented some of the harsher downside to the private sector while still blowing out the fiscal side. And so especially ever since that kind of early 2023 period, we've been in this period where the fiscal deficits are a leading force in the economy, not the only force, but a leading force. Monetary policy is kind of at a back seat, and you have a wider than normal gap between the performance of different sectors because some sectors are more sensitive to interest rates. Commercial real estate being an obvious one because you have both high leverage and short durations and your vacancy problems, for example, in office. So that's like the poster child for something that's heavily negatively impacted. Whereas on the other side of the spectrum, travel numbers, for example, flight numbers are at record highs. And so there's a number of companies that, that are less overall interest rate sensitive and they're more fiscal sensitive. For example, a lot of these deficits are flowing to upper middle class people. They're the ones that have the assets. They're the ones getting higher interest rates on their assets. And they're able to travel. They're able to go out to restaurants. They're able to do these things. In some ways, they're catching up on things they couldn't do a few years ago because of the lockdowns and everything. And so some of those businesses are actually doing pretty well. So you have this really big gap between different sectors of the economy because of the wider than normal gap between loose fiscal and tight monetary.
All right, fantastic description. Lots of questions. Let me ask you this. So, are you familiar with Michael Howell's work?
Yes,
Over,
yes.
over. Okay. So he tracks liquidity, and I mean, it's much more nuanced than this, but he generally sort of says liquidity is everything, right? And if net liquidity is going up, then the economies are going to grow, and financial asset prices are likely to rise. And the way in which he tracks liquidity, global liquidity, it bottomed out in October of 2022 and it's largely been rising since. I think in many ways, for a lot of the reasons that you just mentioned. And that probably does have a very explanative factor. And like I said, I think you just identified for us a number of inputs to that rising liquidity. You talked a lot about how the rising interest expense for the government actually acts as a stimulus because that's getting paid to people that own the debt. So I understand the contribution from that. What do you estimate the contribution to be from just other fiscal spending? So like the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, money that's just getting pushed out in the economy. And again, it's not being spread evenly. It's going into construction and certain other types of industries. How big of a factor is that right now?
I think all of it together is a big deal. If you took out any sort of half trillion or trillion dollar chunk of the deficit, that would meaningfully impact some of my macro outlooks, for example. And what really comes down to is what groups are receiving it and what propensity to spend or what velocity do those have, right? So something like food stamps or stimulus checks, they're going to circulate a lot quicker because they're going to people that are kind of break even to begin with. And so most any extra income they get, they're going to spend. Whereas if you're wealthy and you get extra income, if anything, you're likely to put it into financial assets. You're more likely to get asset inflation than consumer price inflation. You're not going to like buy more energy or buy more groceries because you have more money. You're going to buy another property. You're going to buy more stocks, for example. So those details matter. The ongoing large expenditures in Social Security, for example, they're a big factor. Because now that's operating at a loss. There were decades where they were taking in more money than they were expending, but now that they've hit this kind of demographics cliff, where there's kind of, the baby boomers have entered the bulk of their retirement years, kind of at scale. And so that's actually another really big factor because those are inflation adjusting liabilities. And so, as that money gets out there, and it's more than they're taxing in, they're spending.
Right.
And then
And sorry to
also,
interrupt, but they made a big adjustment to that, I
they
think, in
did.
2023, didn't they?
Yeah, they made a big adjustment. So they spend, they contribute to inflation. Inflation goes up, and then that adjusts higher. And so when people talk about, for example, demographics being disinflationary, for many decades, for a long time, generally older age was pretty correlated with poverty because you'd lose your active income, and if you were not the type that had a lot of savings, you would run and you're not starting a family, you're not expanding your house size, so your consumption's going down, and overall your income's less. But if we're in an environment like we are now, where a lot of the wealth is in the higher third of the population in terms of age, and then if they have a lot of income from these programs as well as from their asset savings, their propensity to spend is not really going down a whole lot. They might not be upsizing their house, but they are going on vacations. They are eating at restaurants. They are, they're contributing to their kids and grandkids' weddings and helping them get a house. And, so that money is to some extent circulating. And so I would say that those are, and then, yeah, the Inflation Reduction Act, some of the construction spending that's contributed to, all those pieces together are collectively, I would argue, inflationary and to some extent stimulatory, at least in nominal terms, in different parts of the economy.
Okay, great. If we get time, I'd love to talk a little bit more with you about a topic near and dear to my heart, which is the growing wealth gap in this country. And it's interesting right now when you're talking about right now we have a demographic situation where the majority of the net worth or most of the net worth is held by the older cohort, right? And it's been great for them of late, right? Since past year and a half, right? Their financial assets recovered and they're doing very well. And because interest rates, the Fed has raised interest rates as high as it has, they can finally again get a really nice return on a fixed income, which you couldn't do, for much of the past 15 years, right? They're actually getting a real return sitting in safety. And so, to your point, like their financial assets, again, which they hold the vast majority of them, are just pumping out income, and so they're out there spending it right now. That is very stimulative. When we get into your forecast for where the economy is headed and where markets are headed, one of the questions I'm going to ask you is how sustainable is that, right? Do we get to a point where maybe there is a market correction, or maybe, finally the Fed has to bring interest rates down and they're not getting as much of a return on that? What are the odds of that? And just to tie in a notion here from Jesse Felder, He wasn't saying it about this specifically, but he was saying it about a lot of other market participants are doing what he calls extending the unsustainable, where they're looking at current trends and they're just assuming they're going to keep going out, pretty much forever into the future. Should we look at what's going on right now with the older, wealthier Americans as something that will be long-term sustainable, or is it something that could, sort of have a nasty reversal in here at some point in the future?
Well, so I think some of that is nonlinear because when you get rising wealth concentration, you start to get rising populism, and of course that can take very different forms. There's left populism, there's right populism, and the way it starts out is some people have legitimate grievances, but then of course it often turns into extremism, and so you get kind of like rational populism, and then you get irrational populism, and so basically the past 40 years. There's been this game of like global financial blackjack, where the best strategy for the most part has been to borrow fiat currency, you're shorting fiat currency, which is abundant, and you're using it to buy assets, so real estate or business equity primarily. And if you can, so in blackjack, you want to get as close to 21 as possible without going over, right? And so in global financial blackjack, you want to borrow money, buy assets with it, but not so much that you blow up in a recession. You don't want to be in the first wave of entities to go down in a recession. You want to be, firmly behind the pack so that, by the time you're in any sort of threat, the stimulus is already happening and you're able to get through it. And we've gone through about 4 decades of that. And the reason it's global is because, there's a lot of those opportunities in any given country, but then also it's global. You can go one country, borrow their money if they have a negative real yield, and you can deploy it into assets in another country. So for example, Warren Buffett, he borrowed yen at basically zero, and he bought a bunch of Japanese commodity trading houses and industrial firms with them, and they performed excellently. I actually did a similar trade. I didn't borrow yen to do it, but I was just in that trade unlevered. And even those firms themselves have debt as well. So they're shorting the yen and they're owning better business equity. And then he even layered on top of it by borrowing yen to buy those already levered entities, right? So he's playing the game of blackjack, financial blackjack very well. So for 40 years, that's been the strategy. And that generally contributes to wealth concentration because the large, large companies and wealthy people have better access to low cost, long duration debt than others. And so the larger, more well connected you get, the better. And if you get all the way to the top, then you get to help craft legislation. You get to call the central banker on the phone when there's a crisis and make sure you get liquidity. So for example, during the 2020, crash, liquidity crisis, pandemic lockdown, small businesses ran into credit crunches, whereas the Fed made sure to get corporate bond markets back open. They made sure to reliquefy those. It's easier to do that. Even if they wanted to open the small ones, it's just easier to open the big ones faster. And then later, when they said, okay, now we want to try to help the smaller businesses, they did the PPP loans. And if you analyze those programs, and those mostly turned into grants, if you analyze those programs, something like two-thirds of it, there's been really good studies on this, something like two-thirds of it went to the top 20% of the population in terms of wealth. So while it's kind of framed as, helping restaurants get through the lockdowns, for example, which is a noble cause. Instead, there's like investment companies applying for PPP loans. There's law firms applying for PPP loans. There's companies that were making software that had no intention of laying anyone off, and so it just goes to the bottom line. And so basically, stimulus checks and childcare tax credits are kind of like the visible stimulus, and then the PPP loans. It's like, okay, we'll give those people 5,000 stimulus, but the PPP loan recipients, they might get 100,000 or a quarter million or half a million in basically what is a gigantic stimulus check. And so that's kind of the strategy we've been on for a while. And I think where it gets unsustainable is that you get rising populism where people, they know something's wrong, but they can't quite say what it is. And so you get more and more kind of populist pushback, more and more demands to spend on other things too then. And then it kind of can continue for a while until it starts to impact things like groceries and oil. And that's when it starts to get messier. That's when it starts to impact corporate margins. That's when, the interest rates start, instead of going structurally down, they start going sideways. And so that game of global blackjack kind of slowly unwinds itself. And I think that's the era that we're kind of shifting into now, but it's not a quick change because the entities that have already been playing that game, they've already locked in a lot of long duration, low rate debt. And so they still have the momentum from, say, the prior decade. Many corporations have 10, 20, 30 year debt at low interest rates locked in their books. And so that's kind of the shift we're going through, but it's a gradual shift.
All right. On that last point, there was a lot being made coming into this year about the corporate debt maturity wall, right? And that there was like almost $1 trillion that was going to re-rate this year, more than $1 trillion next year, I think more than $1 trillion the year after that. I've read recently that there's been, some creative financing that's gone on that sort of mitigated some of the concerns about that. But how concerned are you about it? Do you think that that's a real issue that we need to watch, or do you think that the vast majority of companies have far enough duration still left on their low rate debt that it's really not that big of a deal?
So it's very sector specific, right? If you're in commercial real estate, it's catastrophic. If you're Coca-Cola, you're fine, right? So if you're an investment grade company with fairly modest debt ratios, fairly long low rate durations, they can reduce their debt over time with incoming cash flows. They can just choose not to refinance or choose to refinance minimal of it, and they don't get the tailwind they had before, but they don't really have a huge headwind either. On the other hand, if you're not investment grade, if your business operations are already challenged, if interest expense is a meaningful part of your income, that's when it's an issue, and so you get a bigger than normal divide between different sectors. A funny thing about some of the big oil companies, they've got long duration debt and then also a bunch of cash, like cash equivalents. And so they're in the opposite position of banks. They're lending, I mean, they're borrowing long at low interest rates, and then they're holding cash at high interest rates. And so the higher interest rates go, they're actually like, okay, we're just getting paid more in our spread. And so it really comes down to sector by sector. And it's useful to quantify it because, so in the US, there's something like 140 trillion of estimated household wealth. That's real estate, that's stocks, that's bonds, that's all sorts of different assets, business equity, all those things. And so when you hear, $1.5 trillion of commercial real estate equities wiped out, that's somewhere in the ballpark of 1% of kind of net aggregate net worth that we have. And in addition, we're dealing with, $1.5 or $2 trillion fiscal deficits. And so you have these kind of bubbles of problems, and in isolation, those are disinflationary and locally catastrophic. But in the grand scheme of things, they're absorbable because of this fiscal dominance, large structural fiscal deficits that we're riding elsewhere. And so that's why I think it really comes down to sector by sector, where you have some sectors that are literally an outright recession and have been, and other ones that are doing fine. And I think the net result is something akin to stagflation, where you have maybe low positive real growth or flattish real growth, and then you have decent nominal GDP numbers, because the inflation component is fairly high because of, fiscal spending, geopolitical supply chain frictions, kind of the whole tailwind of globalization, which was disinflationary, is also kind of slowly, maybe it's not unraveling, but it's just no longer accelerating, let's say, kind of the conservative case. And without that, that's another kind of cost friction that's happening. And so I think that's where we're on, is a somewhat more stagflationary type of situation, which you often see in emerging markets. When they have recessions or when they have issues, they often look different than developed markets have looked over the past, call it 40 years. And I think we basically have developed markets with certain emerging market characteristics.
Interesting. Well, look, a characteristic of emerging markets is a big wealth divide in the country. So would you expect the wealth divide in the West to get worse as we proceed into this stagflationary era of fiscal dominance?
So that partially depends on policy choices. So people often debate, is inflation, does that help the rich or the poor? And it largely depends on who's receiving those deficits, right? So for example, back in the 30s and 40s, when they kind of inflated their way out of the problem, they basically inflated away bondholders, which were largely wealthy people, and they did really high capital, they did really high taxes as well, and then they channeled that toward, when GIs came back from the war, they put them through college, they subsidized their mortgages, they spent on infrastructure. That was kind of this like top down redistribution that occurred. So it was like inflationary, but it would actually reduce wealth concentration. And obviously that's controversial, but that's kind of what happened back then. Whereas what we've seen in the modern era is the deficits are actually going toward the middle and the top in many cases. The P, like I said, the PPP loans are turning to grants, corporate bailouts, bank bailouts, redirecting, basically, toward the older, wealthier population. That's where a lot of the deficits are going on in aggregate. So as long as that trend continues, which I expect it probably will, that would probably not be very good for wealth concentration. And therefore, you probably still get this ongoing unresolved populism, both, right populism and left populism. They're all kind of different sides of the same coin. And I expect that to continue as long as we're in that sort of awkward situation.
Got it. And presumably, and one of the questions I'm leading up to is how long do you think this era of fiscal dominance is going to be, and what are the elements that'll get us out of it? But is it possible that if it's a prolonged one, the pendulum could continue its momentum where the wealthy benefit more on a relative basis, but then we get to a point where public ire gets so strong that we then shift and policy starts shifting to be more redistributive and whatnot, and then we start to see more of a 30s and 40s style response, even though we're still in the same fiscal dominance era.
That's something I'm really monitoring, and I think it's jurisdictional dependent. So, for example, an example of a modern one is Japan. They're running pretty sizable, monetized fiscal deficits, inflating away the debt. But if you look at where their deficits are going, they're not going to the military industrial complex. They're not going to, their healthcare costs, despite the fact that they're an older country, is like a third per capita as it is in the US. And so it's kind of circulating in a way that is less disharmonious, let's put it like that. Whereas in the US, because a lot of it's going to military industrial complex, a lot of it's going to kind of a really kind of messy healthcare system
Yeah, just
with all these
corporate
kind of
cartels, I would say, but
Yeah,
yeah.
all this type of things, and it's just not it's not getting spent in a very impactful way, and it's not really going to the people that even need it the most. Even if you wanted to run monetize fiscal deficits, there's better and worse ways to do it. It's nowhere near the best way to do it, and I don't think that ship's going to turn anytime soon. And then the risk is if you like back in the 30s and 40s, that U.S. scenario was like the That was like the best of a bunch of bad scenarios, because if you look at elsewhere, what happened in Europe and Asia, they had similar kind of big redistributions that happened, but that often was accompanied by more extremism, even more thorough kind of redistribution,
Absolutely.
which destroyed capital. And so often what happens is if you let that go on long enough and it metastasizes, then by the time you get a different type of redistribution, it ends up being like it redistributes poverty. More so than it doesn't really redistribute wealth, to put it like
Well,
that,
right.
is kind of the risk I think they were, if they get to the point where they try to do it, they're probably not going to do it in any sort of skillful way. And it's probably going to, not be a particularly healthy environment.
Yeah, may actually make things worse to a certain extent. And I think comparisons to the 40s are tough on this because in the 40s, obviously we were the economy left standing after World War II, and so we were able to basically help all the others rebuild. So we just had this huge amount of demand, right, for our commercial engine, and we were also really in the early stages of. Of really beginning to effectively tap into cheap hydrocarbons, right? We don't have either of those this time around.
I agree. We have worse demographics. So back then, the United States had a structural trade surplus. Now we have a structural trade deficit. So we look more like the UK looked in the 1940s here in 2020s America, which, what happened to the UK after the next, 80 years was not catastrophic, but it was less prosperous than what happened in the United States. Let's put it like that.
Absolutely.
As you said, I am bullish on energy because, We've not done enough investment in there, in my view, and kind of my quantified analysis. I think geopolitics are going to be messy over the next 30 years, and they have been over the prior 30 years. And a problem is that these things, this goes back to my point about nonlinear and like the challenge of long-term predictions, because, for example, sovereign debt bubbles feed on, they contribute to geopolitical conflicts and wars. And geopolitical conflicts and wars contribute to sovereign debt crises.
Yeah.
So it's like this feedback loop that
It's
kind of like,
the reflexology, right, of the sources.
Chaos leads to more chaos until it gets chaotic enough that some order emerges from it. That leads to more order, but then that eventually, gets stagnant and concentrated and leads to chaos, which then leads to more chaos. And I think we're in the deconstruction of the order phase. We're in the shifting toward chaos, fourth turning type of environment, which, it sounds like doomerism, but I just think it's important to kind of, that's where knowing history is important, because if you know those trends and enough people know those trends, then ideally you can avoid the worst scenarios and instead get the least bad scenarios so that whatever emerged on the other side of that is, decent instead of horrific.
Right. And that is the whole reason why programs like this one exist, which is to try to help as many people who are willing to pay attention and educate themselves on what's going on, that they can hopefully make more informed decisions and at least be less vulnerable to these trends, and hopefully in certain cases position themselves to maybe profit from them. And I am also working my way up, Lynn, to sort of what's your market outlook given this type of environment? And I know that there's a particular portfolio structure that you like, the three pillar portfolio. So I want to get to that as quickly as we can. But let me, before we're done with this main first part. So one of the reasons why I'm sort of harping on the differences in the wealth classes here is I'm trying to help people get an understanding of what to prepare for in this type of future. So you said it's going to be more stagflationary, meaning in many ways the beatings are going to continue until morale improves, right? That, like, if you don't like inflation, if you don't like what's happened with inflation right now, don't expect to get immediate relief anytime soon. The stag part of stagflation means that the economy is increasingly slowing, and we haven't gotten, we've been having what, Ed Yardini calls the rolling recessions. Like you said, some sectors are doing horrible, some other ones are doing fine. We haven't yet gotten to the point where job losses have really been a material factor here. Do you expect at some point in this trajectory that they will become material?
So I think even in the context of fiscal dominance, you still have cycles. It's just that those cycles look a little bit different. They have some of those emerging market characteristics. So sometimes in recessions in emerging markets, sometimes you don't necessarily get high unemployment, but instead it's just the cost of everything is higher, right? So groceries, there's people are still employed, but their salaries buy less groceries, less energy, and things like that. And so I think you could see some of that. Like, I think to the extent that we would get an unemployment spike, it'd be more like, say, the 2001 recession, for example, which was actually a pretty low unemployment spike relative to the recessions around it.
Because
Even
it
though
mostly
obviously,
hit several, I mean, specific sectors, right?
yeah, it hit certain sectors and it just overall was less severe. In addition, I mean, when you look at what happened during the pandemic, you had a lot of older workers retire and then not come back into the labor force. And so you kind of permanently tightened the labor force to some extent. And so I think the variables to watch there, one is various types of immigration. They're a factor on unemployment. And then two, I guess if I think of, my base case is not very high unemployment. But if I think of what could challenge that thesis, I try to look what are the tail scenarios? For example, if AI displaces jobs more quickly than my base case, then you could have something that's unrelated to macroeconomics contributing to unemployment that would deviate from how from that macroeconomic lens, right? So I look for variables like that can influence the outlook. So if you put AI aside for a second, for example, I would not expect huge unemployment, even though we could see an uptick. And then even people that are employed are finding that just their salaries are maybe not keeping up with their real cost of living. For example, with high interest rates, and still high prices. The number of hours you have to work to afford a down payment and mortgage payments now, if you're a younger new buyer for a house, is pretty high. And that feels bad, even
Oh,
if
it's
they're
crazy.
employed. Yeah. And so I think that's the type of recession, or type of, maybe not even recession, but type of economic scenario we can be in, where it might not even show up like a recession in some of the numbers. But if you're on the wrong side of some of these trends, it feels really rough. If you already own your house, if you have a low fixed rate mortgage, you're kind of like, the economy's fine. Why, you know, that's why they can't, like, we see these headlines in some of the papers that are like, the economy's fine, why are people complaining, right? And it's because the people writing those articles are often in the position where it's fine for them. It's
They're
fine
fine.
for, yeah.
Or to your earlier point, they're looking at the nominal numbers and saying nominal numbers are decent, you know, relative to historical averages. And you're like, yeah, but the real numbers are awful
Yeah,
or maybe
or
worse.
mixed. It's sector, yeah, sector specific, demographic specific, and I think, and that contributes to frustrations. And so from a portfolio perspective, you know, when we look at the history of the 60-40 portfolio, it often performs poorly, especially in real terms, but even to some extent in nominal terms, depending on the severity, during inflationary decades. So in the modern kind of oil age, let's put it, the 1910s, the 1940s, the 1970s, and the 2000s were inflationary decades, especially in terms of energy prices, but then usually in terms of other prices as well. And so in those decades, invariably the stocks and bonds collectively did not do particularly well. And so in those environments, you know, even if you still hold equities and bonds, you generally want to have another pillar of assets that do better in those more inflationary or stagflationary environments. And that's generally a mix of energy producers, gold, certain other commodity producers, you know, maybe shorter duration treasuries or TIPS, in the modern era, you know, Bitcoin perhaps, those types of assets in that third portfolio slice historically do better, in those inflationary environments. And so even if you're not sure that inflation is here to stay, if you think there's some risk that inflation's here to stay, then having that more balanced kind of three-part portfolio can make a lot of sense compared to only stocks and bonds, which is very much geared toward the expectation of structural disinflationary growth. That's where that portfolio does best. Whereas in any other kind of scenario, especially in an international context, having that other slice, is pretty good for the overall portfolio.
Okay, great. And obviously, the specific allocations are, you know, unique to each person's personal situation, needs, and goals. But just roughly comparing to the 60-40 portfolio, 60% equities, 40% bonds, what is the three-pillar breakdown? You know, is this new slice only like 5 or 10%, or is it more like a third, a third, a third, in terms of what's worked well in the past?
For me, it's bigger than that. So let's say my own age category, I might have otherwise been, say, 80% stocks, 20% bonds. But what I would generally do is say, well, instead of bonds, I'm going to have, say, short duration bonds plus gold. And then for my 80% equity slice, I'm going to make sure that some significant percentage of that is in energy producers or other of these kind of, you know, pro-inflation types of assets, as well as maybe taking a slice and putting it into Bitcoin, right? For that, because it's got that high volatility profile. And so it ends up, you know, for me, it ends up being something like, you know, 20 to 30% of the portfolio or more is geared toward this scenario. And you know, but that can obviously vary based on someone's volatility tolerance, how active they want to be with their, you know, watching their portfolio. But basically, if most of the assets in your portfolio prefer disinflationary growth, you want to protect against the scenario of higher inflation, pressures on margins, pressures on real economic growth because of those higher input costs or some of those base things. And so you want to have exposure to some of those base things, or exposure to some of the hard monies that people flee to if bonds are not seen as a good real return asset.
Okay. I know a lot of people say in an inflationary environment, you want to own assets, you know, that either can't be inflated away, and commodities really fits that bill, their intrinsic value can't be inflated away, or that they have inflation-adjusting income streams. And so where does real estate and owning business assets, owning a business, fall in your crosshairs in a stagflationary environment like you see us having?
So businesses often hold up better than bonds, but there's different types. So for example, if you look at the 1970s, often the way this works out is after a long disinflationary period, the stocks that are at the top of the stock indices are ones that really do well during disinflationary growth, like the big high-valued growth companies. And they're often the least well prepared to enter a more inflationary or stagflationary environment. Whereas the companies that have been doing poorly, the energy companies, the commodity producers, the certain types of value stocks, they're the ones that have done poorly. And so they're a small percentage of the market cap weighting. And so how equities do in that environment depends on one, as you pointed out, ideally you want to have low long-term debt. You want to have either readjusting cash assets or income streams that are readily increasable as just nominal money supply and inflation go up over time. You want to have decent pricing power, so you're able to push you're able to push those costs onto your customers as quickly as they're coming in the door. And then you want to buy that asset at not too high of an initial starting valuation, because even if the business does well, if interest rates go up and people reevaluate the valuation of those equities, it could offset the performance. So, for example, a lot of the stocks, they called it the Nifty 50, like the biggest 50 blue chip stocks in the U.S. back in the 1960s. If you look at their performance by the time you got to the 80s, most of their fundamental performance was amazing. They continued growing. They continued, they did well. But when people were buying them at 30, 40, 50 times earnings, and by the end of that period, interest rates are higher. Now they're down to 15 times earnings. If you double your earnings but you cut your valuation in half, you went
You go
nowhere.
nowhere, yeah.
And that's that we have to watch out for with some of these companies, where it's not just how the underlying fundamentals do, it's what do people pay for those fundamentals. So I generally find, for example, I want to find a company that can pass most of its costs inputs onto its customers, basically decent pricing power, decent growth, is I generating positive free cash flow, and then I'm buying it at a dividend adjusted PEG ratio of below two. So PEG ratio is price to earnings over growth, right? So if a stock is growing earnings at 10% a year, maybe I want to pay up to 20 times earnings for it. That'd be 20 divided by 10, which is a PEG ratio of two. But then I also incorporate the dividend yield. So for example, if a company's growing earnings at 8% a year, but it's paying a 2% dividend along the way, that's a combination of about 10%. If I take that dividend and reinvest it into more shares, for example, then my personal growth rate would be about 10%. So again, maybe I pay something like 20 times earnings for that. It'll depend on what the prevailing discount rate is. What can I get on bonds, for example? What would other people look at this compared to bonds? How would it stand out to them? Is the equity risk premium decent enough? There are some kind of rules of thumb you can do, and you're basically saying, compared to bonds, what is a reasonable equity risk premium that I can get? And ideally, you want that to be fairly high and with a fairly high quality business, which is it's fairly hard to find these days, but they do exist. And just among large cap US equities, that's the most crowded space right now. So that's where valuations tend to be on the higher end.
All right, that's all fantastic. So, thank you, by the way. This is at the end of the day, a channel where people are trying to educate and get ideas on what they should look at with their investments. And I think that dividend adjusted PEG ratio of two or less, that's a great rule of thumb. So, thank you. And I know that there are companies out there that you like. Fundamentally, you just don't. You're not buying them now because they don't meet that. And would Costco fit in that category?
Yeah, I view Costco in that category. So, you're looking at earnings growth of maybe, 12, 15%, but then people are paying 45 or 50 times earnings for it. And so when you see that kind of scenario, there's a handful of different possibilities. One is that sometimes the analysts are wrong and investors are right. So analysts are underestimating forward growth potential. And investors are seeing something in the company that they're actually going to grow earnings faster than expected, right? So if Costco grows earnings at 20% a year for the next 5, 10 years, then maybe that 40 plus, PE ratio ends up being justified. I wouldn't bet on that scenario. It's a mature, high quality company. And so a risk that you get with Costco is, again, the fundamentals might do great for 5 or 10 years, but if the valuation comes down from, say, 47 to 30, even just 37, that could pressure the stock price relative to those ongoing good fundamentals. So I try to watch out for those scenarios, and there will be some that I miss, some that, do better than I expect. And there are other, sometimes I'll pick an investment and its growth will be lower than I expect. But basically, just by being somewhat diversified, trying to kind of catch things early, allows you to kind of have a reasonable portfolio of companies that meet those criteria.
Great. All right. So let me ask you this then. You said that the companies that do very well for the regime that we have been in up until recently, tend to be those higher growth companies. And obviously that's been tech, and we now have the Mag 7. Do you expect there to be some sort of price reckoning here for those companies, which have been such huge drivers of the markets and the overall valuations of the indices? I mean, one of the things they have going for them is they don't have a lot of debt, right? But there are other elements about their back or their composition that maybe don't fit as well this new fiscal dominance stagflationary era.
So I think it's a company by company basis. So for
Is it
example,
okay?
Tesla's at a different valuation than Alphabet, for example. And so I would say that they have very different risk profiles. In general, as a group, I think a lot of them are going to have good fundamentals for the next 5 plus years. Like you said, they have good balance sheets. The ones that have debt generally have really low cost, long-term debt and plenty of cash on their balance sheet to offset it. They're in a really good position from that front. But the challenge is that the ones that are at high valuations could run into an issue where even if their fundamentals do good, it could, their price could fall. And then also, if their growth slows in any meaningful way, then their earnings multiple could come down even further. And so
Which
it's
you
not.
would sort of expect in a stagflationary environment, right? That if the consumer is just getting, if these are consumer companies and they're getting just more and more heavily weighted by cost of living, that they're losing out year after year, you could kind of imagine they're not going to upgrade their iPhone as quickly, that type of stuff.
Yeah, and I think we've been seeing that with Apple. Their top line sales are slowing. They're basically a value stock that's priced like a growth stock,
Right.
which again, the company's great, but and then Apple's actually taken on quite a bit of debt, not because they had to, but because it's that game of global blackjack I talked about. They
Yep.
borrowed, money at 1 or 2%. And deployed it into buying their own equity, which has been a great trade, and that's why Warren Buffett bought it all those years ago. But the problem is that you do that trade, the stock's valued pretty high, top line is slowing. They have a really good existing network that they can monetize, but they're not really growing. They kind of saturated a lot of their market, and then they also I mean, if you talk about geopolitical issues, they're supply chain's very heavily tied to China. So right now there's a lot of capital that won't touch any Chinese stock, even if it's trading, at a super at ultra low valuations, but they'll own stocks like Nvidia and Apple that if there were some sort of, you wake up to a headline between the US and China and their supply chains are in Taiwan or China,
Right.
you're going to have a bad time, even though you're paying very high multiples for them. And so I do think that there are. Again, some of this is nonlinear, but on a risk reward basis, I would say the majority of those big mega cap stocks are more expensive than I'm willing to pay, even though there are some exceptions.
Okay. All right. Well, look, I'm trying to cram in way too many questions into our last couple of minutes here, Lynn. So if we could maybe get to a little bit more of a rapid fire round, and we still have about 10 minutes or so, but dollar, US dollar outlook, and maybe we'll go a little more, well, let's go short term and long term. In other words, what do you sort of see happening in 2024 for these next couple assets I'm going to mention? And then what do you see happening to the asset over the course of this new era of fiscal dominance?
So for the dollar index, as long as they're able to maintain the current situation of fairly tight monetary policy and you know, like they're not expanding their the Fed balance sheet, for example, and they're running these pretty big deficits, and they have decent positive real rates, at least relative to official CPI. I think that gives a pretty significant bid to the dollar, at least compared to, say, the euro and the yen. You know, I don't expect that to go sharply down anytime soon. But there's a couple scenarios to watch out for. Maybe not the next 12 months, but maybe after that. Which is one, if you look at the New York Fed's projections, what the balance sheet's going to do, the Federal Reserve balance sheet, they see it bottoming by, you know, late 2024 or early 2025, and then going up from there at a rate that is roughly in line with nominal GDP. So they will go back likely to monetizing fiscal deficits, and maintaining, you know, reserves in the banking system that are relative to GDP at a certain scale and relative to the money supply. And so that could be a dollar weakening period, or at least maybe the dollar stops going up at that point. And so that's kind of a factor that I'm watching. In addition, you know, whenever the dollar is strong, and this is, you know, Luke Groman covers this quite extensively. Whenever the dollar gets strong, you know, right now, on average, in aggregate, foreign holders have more U.S. assets than than U.S. has of their assets. And so when the dollar gets tight and squeezes their liabilities, a lot of them have assets that they can sell in order to get dollars to meet their liabilities. And so if the dollar gets too strong, usually you start to see disorderly, illiquid treasury markets. You get messier treasury auctions, and then usually some sort of response function comes. Either the Fed steps in and provides liquidity for those markets, or the treasury comes in and shortens its average duration and basically, you know, fixes the supply characteristics of some of those longer duration bonds. Or, you know, like a Plaza accord, basically, like, you know, central banks coordinate to say, okay, this is becoming untenable for both of us. Let's try to manage this down a little bit. So I would expect, to the extent that the dollar keeps staying this high, after 6, 12, 18, 24 months, you get one of those response functions kick in and drop the dollar by some significant amount. So I kind of put that right now in the too hard category, even though it's something I'm watching pretty closely because I don't necessarily think that's the biggest factor. I do expect in the next 24 months, and you mentioned Michael Howe with liquidity. So liquidity bottomed in late 2022 and then went up. I see that in my analysis as well. A lot of that is tied to the dollar index. That basically global liquidity is ultimately measured in dollars. And so the dollar strength is not the only variable in there, but it's a big variable. I do expect a positive liquidity cycle, meaning a lower dollar move sometime over the next 24 months. But I at the moment, I don't have a firm conviction if that starts in the next 6 months or not, for example.
All right, well, let me just make the offer that when you have further clarity on that, you have an open invitation to come back here on the program, Lynn, and tell us what you see and specifically what you think its implications are going to be.
Sure.
All right, so two more assets, and then we'll wrap things up. So we just did the dollar gold.
I generally expect gold to be higher, say call it 24 months from now. 12-month predictions are always challenging. I prefer kind of 24-month periods. You know, I think got a little bit overbought recently. But I'm pretty structurally bullish on gold because I think some of these trends that we're seeing, central bank buyings of gold, a gradual shift toward a more multipolar reserve management type of world, and ongoing fiscal dominance and recognition of fiscal dominance. I think as those trends become kind of entrenched in, I think that gold probably has a pretty persistent bid under it. So I'd expect generally flat to up in any given, you know, long enough period to kind of get past noise and you know, brief overbought periods and things like that.
And just tied to gold, you know, the producers, which have generally lagged the metal so far. Do you think they have a, or, well, let me just ask this. Are you bullish on them as well over the next 2 years?
So my base case is up for those as well. The challenge with some of those is that, you know, oil's an expense for them. Basically, various energy inputs, whether to fuel their machines or even just provide tires for their, big machines and things like that. It's very kind of energy intensive, material intensive. And so if oil goes up as fast as gold, some of their margins can be pressured. Whereas if oil go if gold goes up faster than oil, they're generally in a pretty good position. I think because they haven't really moved yet, they probably have more room to go. I generally prefer the metal itself to most miners, except for some of the highest quality ones. I think that in order to get into that market, you have to be looking at the geology. You have to be kind of doing a lot of kind of hands-on company by the company work. But yeah, in general, I would say I'm fairly bullish on that sector.
All right, and sorry, back to the metal just for one second. Do you expect it to appreciate at a commensurate or better rate than the inflation rate?
I think so. Yeah, I think that again, not in any necessarily 6 month period, but I do expect that there's a pretty large amount of capital that is currently in treasury markets, that is currently in maybe large cap, mega cap stocks at 30, 40 times earnings, and some marginal percentage of that might want to get into gold. In my recent piece, I pointed out, Congressional Budget Office expects $20 trillion in net Treasury issuance over the next 10 years. They historically are conservative with their estimates, so basically the numbers end up being higher than they project. So let's call it 20 trillion minimum. At current production rates and prices, about 2.5 trillion in new gold should come to market around that time. If obviously, so if some percentage of that wants to flow into gold, the price is one of the key mechanisms to absorb some of that. So I would expect pretty decent above CPI gold growth over the next 5, 10 years.
Okay, great. And I realized when I asked it was kind of a silly question because I don't think you would have included it in your three-pillar portfolio if you didn't think it was going to at least keep up with inflation. All right, last, and it's criminal to only give you, 2 minutes or so to talk about this, but Bitcoin. You're one of the smarter analysts on Bitcoin. I'm going to have a lot of people ripping me here that I didn't make the entire interview with you about Bitcoin because I've had a lot of requests for that, but I felt the fiscal dominance topic was relevant to more investors. I believe you're bullish, having read some of your recent work over the next 24 months on Bitcoin, but what, if anything, do you want to say above and beyond that?
So one is that Bitcoin price action is historically very tied to global liquidity, and so a bullish case for Bitcoin doesn't you don't need to be bullish on global liquidity, but it very much helps to be bullish on global liquidity. And so again, next 6 months, I don't really have a firm view, but I do think that liquidity will be higher, 24 months from now than it is now, and therefore I expect Bitcoin to probably also be higher. I also look at various on-chain indicators. So, for example, whenever there's a bear market in Bitcoin, fast money gets out, and long-term holders tend to accumulate. And then when you have one of those big bull markets, so more demand's coming in, but there's not a lot of new supply, and so you have to pry some of the supply out of the hands of longer-term holders, and that's somewhat measurable on-chain. And so prior bull markets, you might have had, for example, let's say 70% of coins haven't moved in a year. They're held by longer term holders. And that might go down to 60%, for example, in a bull market. It might drop by 10, 20%, depending on the magnitude of the bull market. And so far, that's only dropped by a handful of percent. So most indicators would suggest that the bull market is probably still in its middling phase. Rather than its later phase, assuming that global liquidity remains fairly decent. So I'm pretty bullish on Bitcoin with a say a 24-month period. And then I would also add that over a 10-year period, so for example, 20 plus trillion in treasuries coming to market, 2.5 trillion in gold at current prices and production rates coming to market, there's about $70 billion of gold. Of Bitcoin coming to market over the next 10 years at current prices. Production rates are fixed. So the only thing, if more capital wants to flow into Bitcoin, obviously the price would have to go up pretty substantially. And when we enter this kind of fourth turning fiscal dominance, kind of sovereign debt crisis type of scenario, what a lot of governments do is they try to do capital controls. They try to clamp down. And what do what you know keep a captive audience is the phrase that I've seen in research papers by Reinhardt and others. And Bitcoin is mobile capital. It can flow across borders. You can memorize 12 words and bring your capital with you. Obviously, and we've already been seeing this, there's pushbacks against that capability. Governments don't particularly like the fact that bearer assets can move portably, right? So there will be frictions along the way. There will be attempts to surveil it all, attempts to target it with special taxes. This is a jurisdictional by jurisdictional thing. But I do think that that has a big role to play in that type of fiscal dominance world.
All right. Okay. Criminal that I don't have time to really dig further into that, but wonderful summaries, a wonderful talk in general, Lynn. Thank you so much for coming on. Just in wrapping up here, a couple quick questions for you, but important ones. First one being for folks that have really enjoyed this discussion and would like to follow you and your work, where should they go?
So one is they can check out my book Broken Money on Amazon. We talked obviously like a lot of subjects here, and if they want kind of a complete picture, I think that's a good place to start. But of course, they can also check out lynnalden.com for all of my latest research.
All right, great. And Lynn, when I edit this, I will put the cover of your book up there. I'll put the link to it in the description below the video. And obviously, I'll do the same thing with your website. Folks, that if you've enjoyed this conversation with Lynn and would like her to come back on the channel when, whether it's the previous issue that we talked about with liquidity or anything on her dashboard that helps her see things a little bit different than she's seeing right now and wants to give us an update, please let her know that by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Okay, Lynn, what important lesson that you learned, perhaps it might have been from a mentor, perhaps it might have been from a really influential book or paper you read, or just the School of Hard Knocks. What would you like to leave today's viewers with?
I think an important lesson that I've learned along the way is to recognize whether you're in a season where you want to say yes more or say no more. And there's a movie that came out a couple decades ago, maybe called Yes Man, and it was Jim Carrey. And he went through
Yep.
this program where he had to say yes to everything, and it kind of opened his life up to new experiences he might not have otherwise done. So in the growth, the kind of the early growth part of my career, I put myself in a position where I would just say yes a lot, or I'd volunteer to do stuff a lot. Basically, if there's a problem, you volunteer and you say, how can I help fix this? How can I help you fix this? Or, it could be you're trying to in work, for example, you want to, expand your role in the company, for example. And the effective way to do that is basically put yourself in a position where you're saying yes when things come to you, or you're going to others and say, what can I do to help with this situation? How can I, if I'm looking to take on more responsibilities, what is something you need off your plate, for example? And then, when I shifted out of engineering and management, and that's kind of how I, over time, my career developed there. When I shifted into investment analysis, whenever I get invites to certain places or to meet certain people, it's like, yes, of course I'll have that conversation. I don't see how, it's not like I'm going to make money from it, but it's an experience that I want to have. I'm in the process of saying yes, always more. But eventually there comes a time where you get saturated. And it's important to then start to say, okay, time is your scarcest resource. We talked about abundant versus scarce assets. Time is scarce, and even just focus is scarce, being able to kind of tune out noise and focus on high priority. So then you get in a position where you have to learn how to say no more. That sometimes saying yes is actually slowing you down. And saying no at a higher rate helps you do better at the things you can say yes to. And so I think navigating that, transition's been hard. And I think it's a question that no matter where you are in your career or your professional life, you want to ask yourself, like, if I primarily should I be saying yes more than I am right now, either receptively or proactively, or am I in the opposite situation where I should be saying no more? And I think that one of the worst case scenarios is to not be doing the thing you should be doing. So asking the question and making sure you're going in that direction, I think, and that's a huge kind of ultimately simple thing to be making sure you're getting right.
I completely agree, and honestly, I don't really have too much more to add to what you said, except to say another focus in the present to have is to try to really refine your filter as much as you can of what should trigger a yes and what should trigger a no, right? As you get better to say, look, these are the experiences or the things that I want to be doing, experiences I want to be have, the learnings I want to be able to gain. That's what I say yes to. But if it doesn't meet that and it becomes a distraction to these other things that I'm already focused on trying to do, then the no needs to kick in. And if you can do that well, it's like a superpower in terms of catalyzing your productivity in this world.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, look, that was just absolutely fantastic. Lynn, thank you so much. I'm very grateful for this hour and look forward to having you back on the program again soon or anytime in the interim that you want to come back on.
Thank you.
All right. Well, now's the time of the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of the endorsed financial advisory firms by Thoughtful Money. I'm joined as usual by lead partners Mike Preston and John Loder. Guys, great to see you. Phenomenal conversation there with Lynn. I'm sure you guys have a lot of strong reactions to it. John, why don't we start with you? What were some of your key takeaways there?
Hi, Adam. Great to be with you again. Always very much enjoy Lynn's comments. She is an engineer by training. We've come to learn in some off sidebar chats with her. Mike and I are as well. So that's probably why we really, really appreciate her work. It's really deeply thought work and very well put together, logically consistent. Got to be honest, on a busy day like today, it can make my head hurt a little bit because it's so far reaching and so well thought out. But really appreciated her comments. A couple of things that jumped out at me. She talked about the kind of likely transition here to a period of fiscal dominance, and I really appreciated her explaining to the everyday person what that means. And simply, I'll recap. It means that the monetary policy, the Fed and central banks, are supposed to be freestanding entities, independent, not boxed in by anybody, including politicians. And the reality, though, is when fiscal dominance takes play, the fiscal side of the house, the budget, the spending, and the debt issuance, essentially boxes in to some degree the Fed and other monetary authorities from doing what they otherwise would want to do to control inflation and whatnot. So it creates a real, I think, dilemma and maybe antagonism that hasn't been that much of a problem in recent years and decades, but it certainly is now. So it's going to be interesting because here we are pumping out record deficits, and we have a situation where inflation numbers have become stubbornly sticky. Even if we look at today, PCE, the PCE numbers came out today, which is what the Fed looks at and follows very closely in terms of their policy setting mandate. And came out very strong, came out at 3.7% versus expected 3.4. That combined with a weak GDP report, 1.6%, came in way, way lower than was expected. This harkens to a kind of a possible scenario here where we have a stagflationary type environment. Stagflation is essentially sticky, persistent, growing inflation combined with sluggish, very low growth, rising unemployment. That's what the 70s were all about. So I really appreciated Lynn's comments about how she's currently invested and the advising of, don't just be in traditional stocks and bonds. You got to be in the things that will likely do well in kind of an inflationary type of environment. And the 70s are probably the closest example we can turn back to observe that. I'm going to share a quick chart here, Adam. This is one that I shared earlier in the week with you, but I think it's relevant for this conversation because this is a snapshot of what different investment assets did in the 1970s, both on a nominal and an inflation-adjusted standpoint. And here you have the traditional asset classes of stocks, the S&P 500, and bonds, 10-year treasuries. They both lost money on an inflation-adjusted basis. And most traditional investment portfolios, most folks that are going through a robo-advisor or even a traditional financial advisor, they have all or most of their assets in these two asset classes with very little in other things. Kinds of things that Lynn and we frankly agree will likely do well in this kind of scenario are things like gold, commodities, real assets and whatnot. One thing I do want to point out, though, is that even though the stock market did very poorly, essentially went nowhere and lost money on an inflation-adjusted basis in the 70s, this is what the S&P 500 did during the 70s. Point being is there are plenty of opportunities to do quite well in the stock market, but it had to come from pretty large sell-offs. And this gets to the point of Lynn's comments that it's not enough to buy a company or a stock or even one that has growing revenue streams in an inflationary environment. If you pay too much for that thing, it's going to be a very poor investment. And right now, we still sit at near record valuations. So the stock market at present valuations is not likely to get going to be a good forward-looking investment, especially if inflation is sticky and here to stay.
Got it. But to earlier conversations we've had, John, if we end up experiencing an era similar like the 70s with its volatility there in the markets, that's where an active portfolio management strategy really is superior to the passive approach that's gotten so popular over the past 15, 20 years or so, right?
We certainly like to think so. We think there's value to be added for, in all due humbleness here. It's been very challenging if you look over the last decade to add value that way, because things have been so recklessly ignorant to risk or blind to risk. And we think that is starting to matter. It certainly has mattered over the last few years. It may not feel like it, but our clients have done pretty well here on a risk-adjusted basis, much more stable portfolios than the ups and downs that the markets have seen over the last few years.
Okay. So I just again want to underscore two key points I hope folks take away from this entire interview. One is that the playbook is changing in terms of the economic regime we're in, and we're now in this regime, looking through Lynn's eyes, of fiscal dominance, right? And that requires a different playbook than the regime we've been in. And similarly, that requires a different investing playbook, right? And one that's going to probably need to be a lot more active in its approach than the previous passive one that's so many people have been using up until now. All right, Mike, I'm coming to you in just a second. Mike, I want to get your reaction, any additional reactions you have above and beyond what John said. But stagflation is this word that's all of a sudden just been coming up everywhere recently. So I just did the two interviews before this one was an interview with Michael Pinto. And Michael basically was warning of a recession later this year and then a period of stagflation, in his words, greater than this country's ever experienced before. The day we're talking here, the stats were released for the latest numbers for Q1 GDP and the latest PCE numbers, which is important inflation metric that the Fed looks at. And PCE came in a lot hotter than was expected. It was expected to come in at 3.4% year over year. It came in at 3.7% year over year. So obviously got to be very unwelcome data to the Fed, but definitely showing that inflation is still sticky and rising. And the Q1 GDP really disappointed. It came in at 1.6%. So there you have rising inflation. You've got slowing economic growth. I mean, that's by definition stagflation. So I want to dig into those stats with you guys in just a few minutes. But Mike, what else do you have to say, if anything, above and beyond what John said about the discussion with Lynn?
Hey, Adam, just a couple things. I guess I'd like to recap some of the takeaways that Lynn Alden talked about. You mentioned the three pillars that Lynn Alden often recommends, and it reminded me of a mutual fund from many years ago that I was familiar with called the Permanent Portfolio. And certainly don't construe this as a recommendation for that fund, but it's a very simple portfolio. And Lynn Alden's recommendation here seems very simple. The Permanent Portfolio is essentially gold, stocks, in U.S. Treasury bonds. Lynn Alden's three pillars are profitable equities, commodities and producers, and hard assets, cash equivalents. And at the end, when you kind of threw out a few different assets to her and basically wanted to get her reaction, she was a bit negative to neutral on the dollar. I think that we probably disagree with that. It's probably one point of disagreement. We think the dollar is likely to get stronger. It has been getting stronger. In fact, I think it's likely to challenge old highs if we enter any sort of economic crisis and/or stock market crash, which we think is quite likely from these valuations at some point. So we would say we'd be positive of the dollar over the next 1 to 2 years, where she's neutral to negative. But we solidly agree on the other parts, where she's neutral to more, I think, more bullish on gold. And in fact, as she pointed out, it's one of her three pillars. And she's also constructive on the mining shares. I'd like to talk a little bit about that, perhaps, but she's constructive on them, but I believe prefers the gold over miners and Bitcoin as well. Bitcoin is kind of proved itself. It's back up to its old highs, pulled back here a little bit. It's probably here to stay, but we can't imagine a world in which Bitcoin and gold don't both do well together. We prefer to, you know, to recommend gold and hold gold and gold miners. It's something that we understand. And as we pointed out here, almost every week has got a great chart and a nice breakout pattern. So just one last bit there about mining shares. Newmont Gold, ticker symbol NEM. Again, not a direct recommendation, just something I want to point out. It's the only gold stock in the S&P 500. They reported earnings today, and the stock has been a laggard. The stock was up almost 13%, a big, huge move in Newmont. And so there's not a lot of choices in this space. Again, it's the only stock in the S&P 500, And if the gold breakout sticks and fund managers start to get interested, they can buy up Newmont, then they will, by extension, buy up a lot of the other miners. And mining stocks still are a very attractive asset. Perhaps we can share some charts a little bit later, but they have broken out of a downtrend. They came back to test that downtrend. We talked about it here on your program the other day, Adam. And they have since reverted back to the upside and look poised to break higher. So there's also some other things to talk about in the market if you want to get to a little bit later. A lot of earnings reports that we can talk about as well. Some big high-profile names, including tonight, Adam. But I'll take a pause for a minute.
Okay. Real quick, just to remain on gold just for a second. So gold's had a pretty rough week. Last week, it was pretty much near all-time highs, 2,400 or so. But then it really cratered at the beginning of this week. Which, I guess, questions that are on people's minds, which is, okay, what was responsible for the downdraft in the precious metals? And B, is this a short-term thing, or is this something to be more worried about?
I'll take a quick shot at that. Clearly, the de-escalation, if we can call it that, never want to get too premature on these matters, the de-escalation between Iran and Israel last week, that was a big, when things seemed to be called off, so to speak, gold pulled back quite dramatically. So yeah.
Just to be clear, we should all cheer that even if we own gold or not, right?
We'd much absolutely
rather have a lower gold price than horrible war. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the proximate cause, or proximate reasoning that the things de-escalated, and thank God for that, of course. We're very bullish on gold. I saw a post by David Rosenberg, who you have on your program, mm-hmm. and he reminded us that even though we were essentially at all-time highs a short while ago at gold, it's still about 20% below its prior all-time highs on an inflation-adjusted basis. So there's definitely still room to go to even reach prior highs on an inflation-adjusted basis, and we still think there's a very bullish thesis here.
Hey, sorry to interrupt just real quick, because you mentioned him. David's coming on the channel here in early May. So just a quick little plug for that.
Yeah. Great. We'll look forward to seeing him. So here's just this chart, looking at GLD as an ETF that tracks gold. Again, not recommendation to buy this or anything, but this is a daily chart of GLD. And you can see that massive move down late last week on that. But here is the 50-day moving average and the 20-day moving average. We're basically bouncing right on the 20-day moving average. So nothing, this is just one simple technical metric we can look at, but nothing's broken there, so to speak, on a technical basis. If we look at the gold mining space, which we like and have liked for a long time, it's finally had a bit of catch up relative to the metal. We had a very sharp reversal last week on huge volume in that sector. So that was not a healthy thing in and of itself. And a very, very quick pullback. It poked down below that 20-day moving average, but today's move higher is pretty convincing. So we still think there's quite good reason the gold miners can run and play catch up to the price of gold. Lynn, I think, highlights a very important point, though. It's not just the price of gold. We can't go back. There's so many charts out there that will go say and look at what gold GDX, for example, was at a time where gold prices was at some certain level. It's not quite that simple because the stocks trade on the margins, the profit margins. And as Lynn rightly points out, the cost inputs can be a big factor here. If we get in a situation where inflation and geopolitical stability, for example, causes oil prices to rise, or the dollar weakens and oil prices rise, that can cut into the profits of the gold miners. There's a bit of caution that we're starting to feel about you know, even political instability. Many of these mines are located in distant lands that the political environment is quite tricky. But, you know, we're not worried quite yet, but, you know, we think there's still quite a bit of upside here. But there is a, you know, there is a logical reason to have some, you know, concern about the stocks running too far, too fast. And we have some hedges on about half of our position there. But long short, we still think there's plenty of good upside there.
All right, great. All right, well, I get to start to bring this to a close just because we had such a long time there with Lynn. But Mike, I want to give you a chance to just share whatever we're learning right now from earnings season.
Sorry there, Adam. So just a quick recap of earnings. Today, there was three different earnings reports that were pretty disappointing, and these are big, high-profile names. Caterpillar, Meta, and IBM. If you take a look at a chart, all three of them cratered right after their earnings report. And so, you know, coupled with the fact that we've seen a pullback of 5% or so in the market, and we did have a bounce yesterday, it looked like, you know, we were going to get a march right back to the top. But this disappointment started to make everyone think, I believe, that the rally was going to fail. And, you know, this morning, the S&P opened up down 70-something points, almost 80 points. By the end of the day, it was down only 20-something points. And almost went into the green today, which was shocking, given the fact that Meta and IBM and Caterpillar tanked. There were some other ones, but those were the big ones. And then, of course, all eyes were on the two big ones tonight. And this is Thursday, the 25th of April, that we're reporting this, just after 4 p.m. Eastern. The ones tonight were Google and Microsoft. And they were going to set the tone for the market, a lot of people thought. And a lot of people thought they were going to be down because that has been the trend for a lot of these names. A lot of leaders have fallen. A lot of generals have faltered. We talked the other day about how NVIDIA and Supermicro Computer, really the two biggest bubble AI stocks, tanked. So it only made sense that we were going to see this trend. Well, Google just came out after the close and blew earnings away. And the stock went from about 150 up to 180 or so.
Yeah, it's, you know, up, it's about 14% right now. Yeah,
it's up huge. It's up huge. And then Microsoft beat numbers too. And it's up a bunch, not quite as much as Google. So the two biggest tech stocks blew numbers away after the bell. And just taking a look at the charts in the aftermarket, you know, we're going to now be challenging the recent swing high. It looks like the recent swing high will be taken out in the morning if this holds. And I wouldn't be surprised to see some short covering and a move towards all-time highs. And we don't want to be talking like this. You know, that we have a ridiculously overvalued market. It doesn't make any sense. And yet, I don't think we've seen the FOMO, the fear of missing out, that we really expect to see after this many years, after this, you know, many iterations of buy the dip that's completely been supported. You know, after just a rock solid belief that investors and institutions think that every dip is going to be bought and you know, that every little ill is going to be fixed with Fed money. I mean, the belief that the Fed is going to bail out everything from the, you know, Silicon Valley Bank last year to, you know, during COVID, it was a stimulus checks. And Lynn Alden talked about the PPP, Paycheck Protection Program, which was just a giant stimulus check for business owners. It's hard to know what's real and hard to know when this all ends. But all I can say is this is the biggest bubble of our lives. I don't think anyone will ever see anything like this again. And so we believe that we're likely to see a, you know, a big bunch of fireworks at the final end of this thing. And who knows when that's going to be. I wouldn't be betting on it. For most people, I think that actually sitting in treasury bills or equivalents for most of their money and some gold and silver is the right thing to do. But for professional money managers, ones that can run sophisticated hedges, or short-term traders, you know, I would be expecting perhaps one more push higher and then some type of top and then drop before the election. That's just a guess. And it has to do with where we are in the cycle, the fourth turning. We're deep in that cycle. And we have an inverted yield curve that has been inverted for is longer than ever before. This inverted yield curve is going on something like 500 days. I saw a chart the other day, and it's only been one other time that it's been inverted that long. And every single time, well, the other time, I suppose, and every other single time that the market has been, or the yield curve has been inverted, yet not as long, there's always been a big drop in the market. So it's coming. The only question is when. If we had to guess, I'd say it comes in the summer, August, something like that, before the election. Who knows? But so far, these earnings, I think, are a surprise, and they're probably going to drive a big market update tomorrow that could follow through a little bit.
All right. Well, whatever happens going forward from here, we'll have you guys here week after week helping keep folks updated. So thanks so much, guys. As we wrap up here, folks, again, if you enjoyed the interview with Lynn and would like to see her back on the channel, please hit the like button, then click the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And, you know, a reminder for anybody that is looking for assistance in trying to figure out how to navigate their own personal wealth through this era of coming fiscal dominance that Lynn has talked to us about, through the challenges that John and Mike have mentioned here. Unless you already have a proven track record of being a good DIY investor, I recommend that everybody else watching this video work under the guidance of a good professional financial advisor, and one who takes into account all the issues that Lynn and I and John and Mike and I have talked about here. If you've got a good one who's doing that, great, stick with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion from one who does, maybe even John and Mike and their team there at New Harbor Financial, maybe you want to talk to them about how to set up your own three-pillar portfolio, then consider scheduling a free consultation with them by going to thoughtfulmoney.com, filling out the short form there. Only takes you a couple of seconds. But folks, only do that if you're really serious about, you know, focusing on how you want to be positioning your wealth here. These teams are very busy. This is a great public service they offer to folks. And so only take advantage of it if you're really, you know, committed to doing this. Well, all right. Right before we leave, folks, last thing, but very importantly, John and Mike, you guys have an important event coming up that Thoughtful Money viewers may be able to attend, correct?
We do indeed, Adam. And we're coming out your way. Us East Coasters are coming out west. You know, we have clients all over the country, and we're hoping to be able to meet with a few of our clients in LA area and the San Francisco area. We're doing an event, a live event. You're going to be a esteemed guest of ours and very integral to that day. It's going to be on Thursday, May 16th in San Juan de Capistrano, I believe it is, south of LA. And on Friday, May 17th in Palo Alto, just south of San Francisco. One of the highlights, not only your attendance, but you're going to be interviewing another esteemed guest of ours, Jan Van Eck, the CEO of Van Eck Investments. And apropos for what we talked about, Van Eck is an innovator, a pioneer in the area of real asset, commodity, precious metal investing. So I think his firm's pedigree in this realm is going to be really relevant for the times we're in. So we're looking forward to it. Folks can find a registration for those events on our website. If you go to newharborfinancial.com/events, there is a page there with landing pages for both of those two events. And we hope to visit some other cities as the year marches on, because we do have clients all over the country. And it's not just for clients, it's for guests who might see us on your program as well, Adam. We'd love to have, we'd love to fill the rooms and share our perspectives and yours and Jan Van Eck's with those that are able to join us.
Fantastic. I'm really looking forward to it, both to spend time with you guys and meet everybody who attends, and obviously talk to Jan. You know, I don't get to travel too much out of my recording cave here that often. And I really value the times that I get to be able to, wanting to, again, learn from other sharp minds, but also just to get to meet the people that, you know, in the flesh who watch these videos, because honestly, that's where I get the best feedback about how we can make things even better going forward, right? That's where people really can, you know, sit down with me and talk with me about, hey, these are the topics I really care about, or, you know, this is the challenges I'm facing with building my wealth. You know, can you create some videos that would help educate somebody like me? Or, hey, here's a great expert that I don't think you've had on your show before, Adam, that I think would be great. And a lot of times I learned about experts I didn't even know beforehand. So anyways, I'm really looking forward, folks, to meeting those of you that can come meet up with John and Mike and I at these events. I'm really looking forward to it. And again, if I got the dates right, John, the San Juan Capistrano one is Thursday, May 16th, and the Palo Alto one is Friday, May 17th, correct?
That's correct. That's correct.
All right. And we'll have the link you gave to the events. That'll be the pinned comment down below this video, folks. So, all right. Glad we got that squeezed in. All right, gents. Well, look, phenomenal discussion here with Lynn. Great follow-up with you guys. Thanks so much for continuing to do this. week after week, and certainly for all the help that you provide, all the people that reach out to you for those consultations. I hear really, guys, almost nothing but just glowing appreciation from the time and the energy that you spend with the folks that reach out for those discussions. But more importantly, or just as importantly, thanks for doing this with me week after week. And whatever happens over the next 7 days, we'll have you guys back on the channel next week to make sense of it for us. Really appreciate your time, guys. Everybody else, really appreciate you watching. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Adam. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here and to be part of this. We'll see you soon.